Thank you for attending session 277 titled Sacred Resistance, Mormon Women Marching. My name is Anna Shaw. I'm your moderator. You are joining us for the last concurrent session of the evening. After this session, there will be sub sandwiches, salad, and drinks available for purchase on the patio. Mormon fundamentalist singer and songwriter Tom Bennett will be performing on the patio. We encourage you to please join us all on the patio to support the dinner performance. After dinner, join us for our evening plenary in Salt Air with Fatima Salah, who will be preaching a sermon on the least of these. As for this session, the description goes as follows. The Women's March on Washington inspired many Mormon women to gather in sisterhood. Some of us carried the names of those who could not gather physically, sharing a vicarious experience. In Washington, D.C., Natasha Helfer Parker and Gina Colvin led a retreat for Mormon feminists who had come to the march. In this panel, they will share the sacred nature of this gathering and the power of resistance inspired by the spirit of divine sisterhood. Natasha Helfer Parker has been in practice as a mental health professional for over 20 years, primarily working with issues of relational health, faith transitions and journeys, and sexuality. She writes a blog called The Mormon Therapist and hosts the podcast Mormon Mental Health and Mormon Sex Info. Gina Colvin is a research fellow at the University of Canterbury, Christchurch, England, with an, Christchurch, New Zealand. I don't know how that came out that way. It's the end of a long day. With an interest in cultural and post-colonial studies. I'm so sorry, Gina. She is an international editor for Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. Jody England Hansen is a mixed media artist and loves to combine the visual and spiritual aspects of language. She recently returned to Utah residence and enjoys seeing the view of Mount Olympus from both her kitchen and chapel windows. Ladies, the floor is yours.
You guys okay if we stay sitting and just, or do you want to go to the podium? Good.
Sitting is good.
Can you hear if I have this down on the table? Okay. Gina says I've been too loud lately. I can't imagine why. So just a little background. Back in the 1960s, when I was in elementary school, we lived in the Bay Area, and Dad would take a couple of us to one end of a neighborhood and hand us some flyers for the current cause that was important to us. Say, I'll meet you on the other side. And we would just head off. You know, I think this one I was about seven, and I usually had one of my younger siblings with me. And we'd paper the neighborhood, come out the other side, he'd pick us up, and then we'd go to another neighborhood. I've been an activist for over 50 years. It's just the life I grew up in. And so things like, well, back then it was Women's Lib. So before I was out of elementary school, I was known as a libber. And I was proud of it. And then later, I talked about this in another session, Dad was directly in front of the Pope when he was shot, and that inspired him to start an organization to send food over to Poland to support the Solidarity Union. We had rallies, we had meetings, we tabled events, we handed things out, we made calls. I remember being on the phone with on the extension line to listen to a conversation he was having with the head of Solidarity while Lech Walesa was in prison, you know, find out what they needed. And so activism has been very much a part of my life, just not necessarily in the sense that, you know, we're taking over the dean's office. And it's social activism in the sense that if there was a need and you felt that if this is Christ in need, you went and did it. And that was just how I was raised and was very consistent in my life. And I passed it on to a certain extent. As far as I remember, Mike and I have always told our kids, if they said, well, this is happening, we go, okay, write a letter. Well, okay, let's show up. I showed up at vigils against the death penalty with the kid in a stroller and another toddler hanging on. You showed up. You spoke up. And we have this, how many of you knew Wayne Owens? We have a letter from him after my daughter wrote to him concerned about global warming. And again, she was 7. And he wrote this amazing letter back. So we're letter writers. We make phone calls. We show up. We go to vigils. And I march with Mormons Building Bridges. I show up with Mama Dragons. I am a part of organizations that organize letter writing and everything. This is just the way it is. Well, I've dealt with criticism for how I do it and for doing it wrong. I think all of us and any of us who have shown up and done anything, we're used to someone saying, yeah, you shouldn't be doing that, or if you're doing that, you're doing it wrong, or you're doing it for the wrong reason. Activism is something that is not an ego stroke, and it's impossible to please everybody. You get used to realizing, I'm doing what I feel I need to do, and I'm willing to listen and learn. You keep trying to learn. You keep trying to do better. And then you reach across things and you try to do better. And so I feel like this over 50 years of activism was all just a warm-up to the day after the election in November. I was frantically trying to do everything. The day that I never, ever, ever thought that I would see such an event happen and feel that we had regressed so severely. And I was frantically, it was like what I would normally do across the span of weeks I was trying to get done in one day to try to make it so that I was not going to wake up the next morning fearful for my own safety and the safety of so many people who are important to me. And so when I heard about the march, the Women's March in D.C., I checked it out for a while. I made sure it was actually going to happen. And once it was clear, it was definitely organized, they had a permit, I got a plane ticket, and I also got a lot of crap. Same kind of thing. Either I was doing it wrong or I shouldn't be doing it at all. And I'm really grateful that my husband just said, you feel you got to be there, be there. And this reminder that even when I feel worn out and like all the efforts I'm making are not going to stop something from happening, I don't stop trying anyway. And that was a reminder. If you feel like this is what you've got to do, you do it. And so the shirt that for the official shirt for the march was not actually, I could order it, but it wasn't going to come until after the march. So I went ahead and went to one of those sites where they rip off the design and they print the shirts and everything, and I ordered one because I thought, oh, yay, you know, I have one coming for after the march, but I'll get, you know, a rip-off one to where it came and it said, you know, the official logo, the march, and everything like that, and then at the bottom where on the official logo it says Washington, it said Washington. So I just thought, this is really kind of fitting. There are so many things that just aren't what they're supposed to be right now. and so I wore that shirt proudly, and I went to get on the plane. This was while the inauguration was going on, I was catching my flight. And a couple came up to me in the Salt Lake Airport and said, we're going too. And so we were the only ones on the plane that were going. I think everyone else had already taken a flight out. All of the Utah groups that I had coordinated with, they were already out there. But this is when I could go. And so we chatted until it was time to get on the plane. But we're on the plane, and it's delayed. And it's delayed more, and it's delayed more. And we finally took off. And we were assured that we didn't need to do anything, that the flight from Newark to D.C. was delayed as well, and it would be there when we got there, and we could catch it, and we cannot miss this. We've got to make sure we get to D.C. And they said, no, it's delayed, and it's not a problem. We get there, and it had taken off 5 minutes before. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, we'll rebook you, and the next flight was the next afternoon. I said, it's not going to work. not going to work. And the three of us went, we rented a car, and we drove the 6 hours through the night, because by the time we got the car, it was about almost 11. And we drove the 6 hours through the night to D.C. and had a fascinating conversation. And so they had actually come from the Bay Area, where they were visiting people, to a friend in Park City, and then they caught the flight, and they were coming out. And they said, so where did you connect from? And I go, no, I live in Salt Lake. And they go, oh, isn't it hard? And I said, I love Salt Lake. And they said, yeah, but isn't it hard being out there with all those Mormons? And I said, well, yeah, I can understand that, and I'm a Mormon. And they could not believe it. And I said, actually, there are quite a few of us that are going to the march. And they were really amazed. And we had a fascinating conversation. It was a great conversation. And we're, you know, a couple hours into it, because we had plenty of time. And they said, can we give your number to my cousin? She's married to a Mormon, and they've got kids, and we're sure one of them is gay, and we're kind of concerned about them. And this just is such a relief to talk with you. Can you be a resource? And it was just a really great. If it were anywhere else, I'd say it's a missionary moment. and so it was a wonderful experience. And I didn't have cash with me, but I got her PayPal, and I PayPal'd my part of the rental and gas and everything to her that night. And later, just as a note, she contacted me and said, you gave us way too much. I took most of it and made a donation to PFLAG in your name. It was a great interaction. And the wonderful friends who were hosting me there, letting me stay at their house, he drove over to where they were staying. He picked me up, took them back to their house. She got up early with me. Get this, I did not know this until we were on the way. She's an introvert. How many of you are introverts? Would you have gone to that march? See, I can't relate, because I'm not. But I had no idea what a huge deal this was to her to show up at this march, being an introvert. And we go and get on the subway to go in, and the platform was so full, they were limiting who could go in because they thought the platform and the subway would collapse. That's how many people were there. And the thing that was strange is this was not some big rowdy thing. There was this amazing intensity, but almost a calmness through this whole thing. And in a sense, I was relieved, because I was thinking, what if no one shows up? I could not believe it. But I was in such good company in huge numbers. So getting to the mall and interacting with these people, and they just kept pouring in from everywhere. And sometimes there would be a shift where they were over in one place where there were rallies going on, and sometimes it would shift over to another place. But huge numbers of people. And I loved that nearly everyone had a very individual sign that they were carrying. And I got, it doesn't matter how many or how few people, every single person here has their own individual story, their own individual reason. And there was absolutely no violence, no arguing. No one went up to anybody else, even though you would see people with kind of opposing causes. It didn't matter. We shared a reason to be there. And that's what mattered. So we were all expressing this individual nature, but we shared a reason to be there. And this is when I saw, once again, as I felt in so many other ways, this is sacred. To have this connection and yet to be individuals in the connection. Twice we were in a crush. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in a crush of a crowd where really there is no out. And yet there was no panic, and it's almost like collectively there was this agreement without saying anything that you breathe in and breathe out, coordinating, and you push through. And I loved what John Gustav Rathel said in the Why We Stay thing just now. He said, this is something we're pushing through. We can't go back. We can't go around it. We're pushing through it. And these crushes, it was almost like, we will not go back, and there will be times when we just have to push through this. And one moment during this one crush, I remember looking over the crowd, and I just had my hand on my friend to say, just keep breathing. Just keep breathing. I'm right here, and we're going to get through this. And I looked over the crowd, and all you could see were people. And then all of a sudden, this sign comes up, and it says, rise. And at the same time, these hands come up, and they're all holding flowers. And that's all I could see above all the heads. And so just these images that keep coming again. When we were actually marching, by that time, she had had to leave to go to something else. And as I was marching alone with 500,000 of my closest friends, I remember at one point, this man came right down the center of the street against us, and he had this sign with vile images of Hillary Clinton. And he was screaming stuff that I couldn't even tell what he was saying. And it was just like, I looked around and just people just kept going. And they would hold their signs up and they just stayed calm and they kept going. And the same thing happened with the woman who was calling us all baby killers. Just keep going. And another image, I was walking behind a woman who had her little girl on her shoulders. And the little girl was holding a sign, I recognize children's scrawl. I've taught children's art. And this little girl had made this sign herself. And it took me a while to figure out. It said, girls should be treated the same. And then after the march and everything was emptying out, I stood in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And what had been full of people, there were very few people there. And there was scaffolding. And it was like all these workers in dark jumpsuits were all over the scaffolding dissembling it. And it reminded me of an Amish barn raising. And then I went to grab a bite alone in this cafe, which was packed with people. And I started, you know, people next to me would say, hey, you know, where are you from? And we'd start talking. And I pulled out the prayer flags that I had taken. These are the prayer flags I made, covering with names of people who couldn't be there who wanted to be. And so I had several hundred names that I carried with me. And even as I was marching, sometimes I'd pull them out and just hold them like this. Because we do work vicariously. We do speak names. And by speaking the names, we bring life to the present. And so I told them about this, and I spread the names out and talked to them. And they were really caught up in this. And this young woman turned and said, I am so glad I'm eavesdropping. Because I have had this idea of what Mormons are. And you've completely changed it for me. And I am really glad. And so it was great. And then from there, I went to the Mormon women's retreat. And one of the women there had, instead of prayer flags or fabric, she had written the names all over her body. And it made me think of what Christ says when he says, I've engraven you on my palms. We so inherently are part of each other. And when any of us, one of us, is threatened or hurt or afraid, we've got to get that it impacts all of us. And we've got to show up for each other. One thing that I've noticed is on that same day, I didn't know until later when I was invited to be a part of it, there were groups that were starting of women who had never been activists. And for the first time, they felt the need to do something. They could not let this be. And these are women who are very active at church, and it's all they've ever done is that kind of activity. And they just felt the need to do something, and I was invited to be a part of some. But the thing that I've noticed is in these gatherings and in the conversations, here are women who are taking all of their experience of running auxiliaries, of not being paid for what they do, of seeking guidance and inspiration, of being creative, and having to do things without really a main authority. And they see a need, and they're coming together, and they're doing something to change what's happening in their country. And not once has any of them said, I checked with my bishop or stake president. I got permission from my husband. Nowhere. It was just, I saw this happening and I had to do something. And in a sense, they are discovering something about themselves and how they can function in ways that they had never thought of before. And to me, that's a sacred process that I was watching. And they will never do things the same again. So again, who would have known that pushing through something like this could possibly be the beginning of huge changes that have not come any other way? When I think about, just in conclusion really quick, many people have said, why are you doing this? Why do you do this? It's not going to matter, it's not going to work, or it's not going to make a difference, or it's just, you're not showing support. And, a lot of different ludicrous reasons. And a number of times in recent years, when people suggest I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing because this is not what Mormon women are supposed to do. And I say to that, the church made me. I do what I do because of what I grew up with and what it speaks to my heart. It is because I started standing and speaking at a podium before I was 5 and ever since that I have been able to testify before legislatures and lead rallies. It is because I have been helping run auxiliaries and quorums, and make no mistake, women are behind the scenes in everything. And we have to help make sure things are running. And whether it's my stewardship or not, without official authority and for no pay, often without help from leadership and with no budget, it is because of that that I know how to step forward when something needs to be done. It is because of the church that I learned that nothing compensates for failure in the home. This is my home. And at some point I say, not in my house. This will not happen in my house. It is because of the church that I really do think families are forever, and that this great, complex, messy family of God is a place of learning where we learn to be connected. And nothing in this family is more important than learning to love one another. And nothing is a higher authority than direct personal inspiration from God. The main question I feel that I need to ask is, did you see me hungry and feed me or clothe me or comfort me? And if someone tries to say, well, yes, except for those who are refugees or disabled or of color or uninsured or queer or female, I will resist. Like the woman who had no station, no name, no authority, and yet she saw and recognized the sacred and brought her best ointment and broke it open. And in the face of resistance, created a sacred space for the Messiah by anointing him. I must create a sacred space in every way I can and anoint each person around me as a valid, important, worthwhile person, and witness them resist all there is that seeks to diminish them. That is the sacred space of resistance that I feel we all have an opportunity to experience. caffeinated.
Is this also something you can hear me? No. Hello. Oh, it's not even on.
Turn on.
Now?
Yeah.
Can I hold it down here and you can hear me?
No.
Hello. All right. I'm just going to start off with a personal acknowledgement that I am at the end of my emotional well-being today. And what I mean by that is I'll probably cry through a lot of this because I'm now talking about a personal, very personal experience and not in my mental health professional aura, which I've already done twice today, which was already stressful. And so I guess I'm just asking you to bear with me, if possible. I grew up, mainly educated in the United States system, where we learned about many social justice movements. And I will never forget the moment that I sat down with my dad, and he told me that at his high school, there had been segregated water fountains. Because I had learned about segregation, and I thought that's how, in my 12-year-old mind at the time, or somewhere along those lines, I thought, well, that must have happened 1,000 years ago, right? 5,000 years ago. But the reality that my own dad had experienced that drew a very stark realization of how close my experience was to really some very traumatic experiences that we've shared as a nation, and that we're not that old to begin with, and it really wasn't that long ago that we've had pretty horrific things like slavery and women being considered property of men and having very little rights for their own education or authority. And so those kinds of themes always drew a lot of interest from me. And I had parents who grew up kind of identifying as hippies and in that movement in the Vietnam War era. And so listening to their experiences and their ideas about social justice definitely impacted me, as did, I think, my own personality and my own heart, thank goodness. So I was thankful for the the sacrifices, of our, of the people who came before, the Martin Luther Kings and the Rosa Parks and the, all the suffragette women and, just so many people who have resisted and who have stepped into that space of risk and vulnerability that is usually comes at high cost and high personal cost, and thought, wow, I'm so grateful because now, we don't have Holocaust and we don't have racism and we don't have sexism, and I just live in this wonderful world where those things just really don't exist anymore, and I'm so grateful for these, these people who made that possible for me, not understanding the very institutionalized issues that I would come to realize were very much a part of my existence. And also understanding later that privilege played a big role in that as well, due to my skin color and my socioeconomics and the fact that I had parents who supported my education and many things that many people just don't have in their lives, along with church community who also offered a lot of support and structure. So as I went on to become a mental health professional and studying the social sciences and systems theory and all these things that we tend to study, it became interesting to me to understand how change happens, right? How do we individually change for the better? How do we change as a system, like a family or even a larger group? And of course then societies and how they face change. And what I recognized that I was normalized for people is that the classic, you take three steps forward and you're going to probably take a step or two back. That progress is not an ongoing uphill line. that, and I'll say this to my clients all the time, you know, your progress will probably look a little bit like our economic cycle, you know, where there's been some depressions and recessions, but the stock market eventually, you know, has an upward swing, but there's a lot of bumps and roads and roller coasters in between. And I thought this was a very clever way to explain, you know, the complexities of change in people's lives. So when I started coming up against some of the issues that I was finding problematic in my own, especially church culture, around issues of feminism and sexuality and LGBTQ issues, and then not only seeing that step back in my church and retrenching, but also in my country, it shouldn't have been surprising to me, given that I have this kind of framing, and yet I found myself profoundly shocked that I felt like I was losing my church and my understanding of myself in it, and that I was losing a lot of my identity as an American, because I could not understand how comments about sexual assault and women's rights that were so profoundly disgusting and distasteful to me were not deal breakers in our country, where we have held people accountable for the way that they laugh, the blowjobs that they may or may not consensually have received, and many other things that have ruined people's careers politically, as maybe they should or shouldn't have, but that this was a full-blown acceptance of horrific things, regardless of your political leanings. So, when I heard about the march, for me, it was a very personal invitation to take part of something that I had always assumed was behind me, that I would not have the same type of opportunities because we've progressed so much that my, you know, the people in the 70s and in the 60s did when they were marching for civil rights and women's rights and all these types of things. And so it felt like this invitation to be a part of something much larger than me and in connection with many other people in our country. I specifically was concerned about the fact that, you know, half of the murders of women in our country today happen at the hands of intimate partners. Over half of the murders. And the sexual assault rates in this country are atrocious. And the amount of women's sexual assault stories that actually make it through a legal system where there's actual accountability is less than probably 8%. And that's of cases that are even brought to court. So we have real issues when it comes to female rights in this country, and for me, female rights and male rights are intertwined, because you cannot oppress without becoming oppressed, in my mind. And so this isn't a female issue, this is a human issue. And I love the men in my life, I love the women in my life. I don't think that females or males are better or worse, or and all the myths and horrific things that we say about each other's gender are actually quite painful for me when we put down men in really inappropriate ways, which is allowable in our society because they have a lot of authority they shouldn't have, and when we put down women in very ways that are not as upfront, that we don't even realize we're doing it. So those are kind of the themes that I notice. It hurts all of us. So, as I decided to be at this event, which was not cheap and was not easy, coming from Wichita, Kansas, I was able to collaborate with Gina, and we decided to turn it into a bit of a retreat experience, which was really wonderful to be able to deepen my friendship with this wonderful woman who sits next to me as we planned for this event. And we really focused on this idea of the interplay of the words, right? Like resistance, aggression, advocacy, these can all sometimes be very powerful words, and even with negative connotation. And when we think about sacred and special and Christ-like, those tend to be quieter words, and how we can bring those, the meanings of those words together, and really honor the fact that our Christ that we worship was a revolutionary and did nothing that anybody liked. And I don't know why we're told to be quiet and Christ-like, in a sense that I can't laugh loudly or bring my own personality to the table. So I reject all of that because I think Christ was badass. Started knitting my hats. I knit one for you that I finished at 2 a.m. prior to the march. And I did a very Mormon thing, which is take names with me, as did Jody and several other people. It's not just really a Mormon thing. I think lots of people did that because it was really an honor and a privilege to be able to share this experience with so many people who wouldn't have the opportunity to do this. And I not only took names, but I asked for reasons why people would have marched. And those are what I wrote on these quilts. And I thought I'd have this quilt finished, and you know how that goes. So that's most of my life. I was sewing in the back corner of the Sunstone corridor. I felt very Molly at that moment, and I owned my Molliness. Okay. I did think about the risk factors. I'm not going to lie about that. I thought, what a perfect opportunity for people who are not happy about this movement to have a whole lot of people in one space and be able to hurt them. So that did not go without thought. And I'm a mom of four kids. I don't want anything to happen to me at this particular time in my life. So that was one thing I thought about. I did not feel any risk in the sense of estrangement from my community. That's already happened for lots of other reasons. I did not feel that risk. But I did feel a sense of physical and personal risk that I was going to go do this. I didn't know exactly what to expect. And in fact, even at the retreat the night before, we had been trained to help the women who were at the retreat have some preparation for issues in case it went wrong. So we had like lawyers' numbers in our pockets, and we had ways that, you know, if we were going to be arrested or if we were going to deal with any type of issue, that we might be prepared for that. Ended up being a moot point, thank goodness. And I just want to share a little bit about just the magic I felt around this event. From the moment that we put on our hats and left in the morning, Gina and I were staying at Suzette's house, and she was very lovely to host us, and just taking the first train and starting to see the sea of pink, and that it was trickling out of the woodworks, right? It was just like all these little pink hats and people floating by and starting to conglomerate. And right away we ran into issues. Right away we went to the subway or the train system.
Delays,
not enough tickets. I had not prepared and had a ticket. Gina was very kind to wait for me. And eventually, you know, so we had to watch the conductors and the people who were working at these events have to, you know, struggle to know what to do next. They eventually just opened all the doors. So I didn't even buy a ticket. I just got on the train. And, you know, you've heard the term in a sandwich, in a sardine can, right, in these types of trains. I cannot tell you how true that was because it was already packed when we got in, and there was like four different stops, right, still to get to the point that we went into. And so everybody trying to squeeze in just to get off the train at the metro station was a huge people jam. We actually sat in the train station for an hour underneath, not being able to go up the escalators because there were so many people trying to get out on the streets. And instead of being annoyed and irritable, which would have been very easy to do, we were all quite in a good mood. We loved each other's signs, we smiled at each other, we were patient, there was obvious recognition of people who were struggling, the elderly, the children, the moms, the with young ones. It was really quite beautiful to see so many people from so many backgrounds, so much diversity, be able to be so kind and lovely with one another. It was really a spiritual event for me from way before we even made it to the march. The sisterhood included women and men of all ages. And that was profound. It was profound to see the little girls on the shoulders of their dads who had brought them to be part of something where I could see the fathers wanting their daughters to know who they were and to own their rights as women. It was very touching to see elderly women in wheelchairs at such an event, to see their signs saying things like, "I march again." Or, you know, snarkier ones like, "I thought I wouldn't have to march by this time. It's 2017. Right? Or 2016 at the time.
How many more times
am I going to have to show up at one of these things?" And yet they were smiling and very gracious. I loved seeing the young college men take opportunity of many, many women in their midst with great t-shirts that they came up with supporting their female counterparts. I thought that was quite wise. And even in the moments, you know, Jody says that there was no panic. Gina and I panicked. We were not very helpful. We were like, "Everybody move! Everybody go this way!" And then after about 5 minutes of that, we were like, "Yeah, that's not working. I guess we better just shut up." It was scary. It was scary. When you cannot move in an entire street because there are people up against your body, it's a bit claustrophobic. And even then, even in that impossibility, I saw elderly people being carried out. I saw little children who needed to urinate. Like, there was these tiny little paths that people somehow created for people who needed those paths to be there. It was amazing. As we, marched, it was wonderful to see the diversity of the program. It started and ended with Native American song. There were moments that Gina and I cried together. There were moments that Gina and I laughed together. We had hoped to march with the women, the Mormon women. We never made it to them. We couldn't get to them. I mean, there was just no way. We could kind of see where they were. There was just no way to get there. So we got to have a profound spiritual sacred experience together. And I missed parts of that because I would have liked to march with our friends. But at the same time, it was very special to share that with you. I felt very American. Do not tell me I do not have the right to share my voice in this freaking country or that I'm a snowflake because of it. F that. That is ridiculous. That's the most un-American thing I've ever heard. I heard you guys shout your voices for 8 years. I will now shout mine for at least 4. And that's what we can all do because we are American. That's the rights that we have. There's nothing snowflakey about that. And I will honor your stupid voice, and I hope you honor my stupid voice. And I felt so Mormon because I have been taught to stand up for what I believe in. And I have been taught to do hard things. And I have been taught to advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. And I plan to continue to do that for many more years to come. Thank you.
Natasha and I were sandwiched on the metro going back to Virginia after the march, And we got talking with a young man, an older man actually, from Virginia, oh, not Virginia, New Jersey. And he said, you know, I'm a veteran of this stuff. I go to every march there is. He said, but that march, that was something else. I just got to call it the feminine divine. And if that's the feminine divine, I want me some of that. So I really want to wrap it up by just talking about sacred resistance more generally. When I was, once on my holidays, I was staying with my grandparents, June and Ron, and they happened to live down the road from this really nice pool, and and I was there by myself. I usually stayed with my cousins, and I really loved to swim, but this wasn't my neighborhood, so I had no friends to go along with me. And when you're 10 and you have no one to go swimming with, it can be a really lonely experience. Just, you know, think about it. Like, everybody is having fun. Everybody's, this is an immense joy and noise, and everybody getting cool together and dunking each other, and there I was all by myself. So I slipped very quietly. And Jody asked before how many introverts there are, and I put up my hand. I actually am an introvert. This is hard stuff for me to talk publicly. I kind of like just my own space. But anyway, so I slipped quietly and unnoticed into the pool, just sort of muffling. You know how you do when you get into the pool and you, it's so cold. I had no one to talk to, so I just sort of muffled my sharp expression of air. And going underwater when you're alone is as close as you'll ever get to a recreational flirtation with death. And so every rebound into kind of breath and the air again is an exultation that death was defied. And on this day, with this a million cascading liquid diamonds pouring off me in this press of frolicking folks, none of whom nodded my reemergence into the world with a smile or a look of recognition, if I'd stayed submerged, I was sure no one will have noticed until it was all too late. That's how moribund I was as a child. I remember it. So when I got out of the pool, I was still filled with this dull ache of my aloneness, and I stood against this tall concrete wall that curved around the eastern end of the pool where it fanned out into this paved sunbathing area, and it was there that I found myself hemmed in by a gang of boisterous teenagers clamoring about on towels, trying to be admired by each other, the boys for their wit and their daring, and the girls for their bodies and their pretenses of indifference. So I stood there against the wall, watching, and too afraid to move, too afraid to draw attention to myself to be noticed, and I baked. So the heat of this, I don't know if you've been to Christchurch, you'll know that the summer sun is relentless and it's harsh, and it absolutely lacerated my face and my body and my arms, and I burned. Now, I don't burn easily, thank you, my father and his semen, but I could feel this really hard light of summer sun cut away at layers of my skin like a hot knife, but I still struggled to move. I was paralyzed by the shame of my aloneness and the horror of knowing I'd draw attention to that aloneness and my efforts to get out of the throng. When the crowds thinned, I stole up the courage to move, but not before I heard one of those teenagers say, "That girl's been standing over there for ages," at this sea of heads swung in my direction, nodding toward me with a tone of incredulity as I shrank further down into my shame. I eventually carried those burns and my humiliation home to the tut-tut of my grandparents, who wondered how in one afternoon I'd managed to turn from this deep summer brown into something unrecognizably ruddy and hurt. If only I could have moved away from the wall. I'm going to fast forward to when I'm 16, I'm the Laurels class president. I was invited into a leadership meeting with the General Young Woman's Presidency. The room was filled wall to wall with my church mothers, and it felt sacred. An invitation was extended to ask questions. Now, reluctantly, at the back of the room, I raised my hand because I had something gnawing at me for a long time, and I just had to ask the question because I'd been feeling that something didn't feel right. I was surprised that among a sea of hands, I was quickly called upon. And my chest pounded and my mouth felt dry. At this stage, I was entirely unused to speaking up, but I looked around at these women that I loved, and I saw their smiles of encouragement, and I said, "I'm the Laurels class president." And Sister Beck, Julie Beck, was the General Young Woman's president at the time. She said, "What's your name, dear?" I said, "Gina." She said, "Sorry, speak up a little louder." I said, "Gina." She goes, "Oh, hello, Gina." I said, "Hi, I was wondering what young women in the church have to look forward to aside from marriage and children." And there was complete silence. You could hear a pin drop. And I realized that as a 16-year-old, I had the rapt attention of adults, and I was terrified. I could still feel that warmth and encouragement, and it kept me going. I can see that there's a lot done for young men. They get the priesthood and they get to participate in the sacrament. They get to go on missions and then they get to choose careers and even wives. But I don't know what I can look forward to. Personal progress just isn't making me feel good. It feels like young women don't matter as much as young men. What do young women have to look forward to? Because even marriage and children depend on boys. What's our place in the church? I probably didn't say it quite like that. I probably said it quite like that, but not quite with those words, but this is as much as I can remember. And I felt my face flushing hot, and was really worried that I'd said something that would dispatch me to the, you know, get me released or whatever it was. But instead, there was kindness, and there was an issue, there was safety in this space. And as it happens, the young woman's presidency agreed with me, and they promised to take my question back to the Brethren in Salt Lake City. And I waited to get their response. I was momentarily heartened, but I was also concerned after a while that they didn't. And it occurred to me that they don't actually have the right to make their decisions on behalf of the girls that they apparently preside over. And I noticed in the ensuing months of waiting for a response from the General Young Women's Presidency that perhaps they were actually powerless to take any action independent of men to whom they reported. Their only power was in their right to ask the priesthood for permission. And that aroused, consequently, a lot of anxiety in me that I tucked away at the back of my mind, where I have over the years toyed with the idea that the greatest threat to women's organisational development and growth is the all-male priesthood, the patriarchy. And while we're all subject to an all-male leadership, we'll never be entirely free as Mormon women. So it was at this point as a 16-year-old girl that I began to put two and two together, that we women are subject not just to church, but to a social system not of our creation, a system that privileges the masculine, that gets celebrated and paraded, a system that throws resources at and allows unfettered access to God, while we women are consigned to wait for male permission to become our best divine selves. We must always court favour, ask permission, assume a posture and of subservience, and relegate our feminine concerns as of secondary importance to masculine concerns. This Mormon patriarchy, I began to understand, is utterly bound up and too distracted by their concern for the maintenance of their own authority to pay more than a passing and cursory attention to the needs of half the world's people. And this occurred to me because of my church mothers, who I'll get to in a second, who have showed me in a thousand different ways that they too are unhappy with the status of women in the church and the world. Now, here's an example. I was newly in Relief Society when the teacher began to recite a quote from Bruce R. McConkie. This hand shot up from the aisle across from me. It was Sister Speak, S-P-E-K-E. The teacher looked up mid-sentence and invited Sister Speak to share her thoughts upon what she said in a not-too-pleased tone. Could you not read Bruce R. McConkie? I hate that man. To wit, without skipping a beat, Sister Hegarty replied, oh, sorry, and flipped the page and moved the lesson on past McConkie without a single flicker of alarm. And I think that she was able to do this, and it didn't cause much of a problem, because my church mothers established the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Christchurch, New Zealand. My church mothers were more often than not women with non-member husbands, and so they worked hard to raise children in the church. And they were at the same time creating, at the same time they were creating it without very much support. Their work was central to the development of Mormonism's infrastructure in my city. We wouldn't have chapels, we wouldn't have a Relief Society. I doubt that we would have a church if it had not been for the woman. They were a force to be reckoned with. They were tough and hardworking, outspoken and passionate, and could even make the most hardy and resolute of men cower and shrink in submission. We still have that. They loved the church into being, but they didn't mean that they could be managed by the patriarchy. The local male leadership knew this about the woman. No male was worth his salt in my city. Would think to even cross someone like Margaret Kamick or Beth Colwell with their resolute and determined hearts and their spiritual temerity and their ferocity. So this feminine independence and reflex to speak up and to claim our right to be present and taken seriously at the table of leadership was in the Mormon waters. Mormonism didn't start in Christchurch or probably anywhere else in the world like it started in Utah. Our pioneers didn't walk across the plains. They didn't bury their dead along the way. They didn't arrive in the valley that Brigham Young declared to be the right place or the place or the, I don't know, what sort of place. They weren't polygamous. They weren't contending with questions of slavery. They weren't settlers and colonists come to Zion. They were people. I do like Utah. That's why I keep coming back. So just in case you felt offended by that. They were people who lived in leafy Christchurch streets at the bottom of the world in modest Christchurch bungalows who found themselves in deep and transcendent conversations with a companionship of two poor Mormon missionaries from Utah. And they were largely Protestants who were aroused into Mormon conversations that were wider and deeper than any faith tradition had taken them about their spiritual potential and their deep love of God. I was a gospel doctrine teacher for 8 years, and wherever we got to talk about why people joined the church, there would be this undeniable sense of sacredness that came across people, and they said, we joined the church at great cost, but it offered us the idea that we could be like God. And my cultural mothers were usually really good at speaking their minds and naming their concerns, but not all of them could see the systems that perpetrated these gender imbalances and injustices. So as I matured, I came to understand that it isn't good enough to say simply how you feel. You have to speak up at the same time to the reason why things are the way they are, and you have to develop a will to change things the way things are, to question the reason behind the reason for their coming into being. And to do that, you need to be unafraid, or afraid but swallow it down and do it anyway, because the patriarchy is largely concerned with the preservation of itself. And a woman needs some steely resolve to confront the perpetrators of this kind of gendered spiritual violence. Mormon gendered spiritual violence is executed benevolently, but is nonetheless systemic, and it's also harsh and abusive. I was recently quizzed by a church leader in a meeting wherein several men were present. He said, I don't know why you keep calling this church a patriarchy. And this surprised me, because the person in question was a very bright man and intellectually impressive in his own right. He's a law partner. I said, well, here I am being institutionally interrogated about my behaviour to an all-male audience, and you know that there are no forums or councils or committees in which the opposite is true. There is no institutional context in which men are required to account for their behaviour to women, and that is a patriarchy. He didn't have a comeback, which was lovely. I counted that as a win. So many inside and outside of Mormonism have asked me, sometimes not too kindly, if you don't like the way things are, if you don't believe in what we or they believe, why don't you just leave? And I'm not sure these days what it means to leave the church. There are those who don't go to church but who are Mormon in their very bones and their DNA, that it's a nonsense to ask them to leave. Leave what? Their identities, their ancestors, their families, their communities, their love for the faith, their desire for a better Mormon experience. There are those who stay on the pews who pay the price for that privilege, but by swallowing down their comments into silence, all the while building and building in their resentment towards the community that won't hear them, that won't open a space that admits them into the conversation. And there are those like me who speak up because it feels right to want more for your faith tradition than it's currently providing. But I've lost status in doing so. I do it because I know what the faith can be because of my church mothers in terms of community, care, and love that it provides. Last night I spoke about my mother, my depressed and unmarried and, mother who had been sexually abused. Now, when my mother couldn't take care of me, she went to a woman in the ward and she said, I felt the Spirit told me that Gina should live with you. And this woman took 30 seconds and said, I just felt the Spirit tell me that's exactly what needs to happen. And I was homed. I was given a home by this woman. Not after other woman, Mormon woman, had come in and looked after me. So I know what Mormonism can be. Mormonism Zion is this hope of something better and our offering of healing to the world, but we've left Zion by the wayside in a forgotten place where we get on with the business of empire building. Mormonism's building projects, property acquisitions, corporate reputation, businesses and financial portfolios seem to have become more important than Mormonism's heart, which I believe is filled with grand and beautiful and audacious visions of cosmic and godly consciousness and connection with the feminine, masculine and the feminine divine. Who else provides that? But something has gone wrong, and I believe that is out of order. And the patriarchy is drunk and reeling and stammering across our souls with foolish and heartless abandon. Good intentions and benevolence aren't enough to help this blundering spiritual buffoonery out of its own undeserved hubris. So there. So I resist. Thank you. Thank you, my love. So I resist, but I do so by standing my ground, being clear about what I think could be better, and I do it with gentleness, compassion, and a bit of humor. And I do this because I think it's the best way of being heard. I've made the mistake of bludgeoning people at church with my irritation and frustration. They became like kind of like rats on a ship. Every time I walk in the room, they go off to the side and walk along the wall. Don't make eye contact. She's going to ask me about tithing. So right now, my resistance is firm, but it's tempered. For instance, my state president, who was after me for a temple recommend a couple of years ago, and I don't know why. I think he maybe thought that if I had a temple recommend, I'd simmer down. So he invites me into his office, and I say to him, and I had this moment of blinding clarity. I said, Jared, because I didn't call him president. Jared, do you know what this feels like? It feels like a cervical smear test. And I think it took him off guard because he didn't probe too deeply. Do you know what a cervical smear test? A pap smear. Like, you know, up the jacksie. Sorry. He's continued to check in with me when he gets calls from the cob to rein me in. He summons me to resolve concerns, often occurs when I'm just about to fly to the United States. I don't know, I think it's an intervention. It's a godly intervention. For instance, when the policy, after the policy, I angry blogged, and the executive secretary called me to an interview to resolve concerns, I text replied with, I'm sorry, I can't because I'm just about to leave to the US to call the brethren to repentance. The reply was, oh, have a nice time. We'll see you when you get back. If I want to end in spiritual abuse, I need to love my state president but hold my ground. He knows that I love him and respect him, but that I won't yield if he doesn't give me a good reason to. Tell me how I got it wrong, I said. And he invariably replies, I'll have to think about it. I don't know if he thinks about it, but he never gets back to me about it. The other week, I was summoned again to a meeting to resolve concerns. I replied to the executive secretary, I'll come along as he agrees not to dominate me with his priesthood. The reply was, awesome, and I'll tell President to tone down the unrighteous dominion. And it ended up being a wonderful conversation about meditation. The idea of sacred and resilience is beautifully penned by Maya Angelou, who said, out of the huts of history, shame, I rise. Up from the past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave, I rise. I rise, I rise. Passivity, docility, and inertia are not going to bring the shalom, the dynamic harmony that God wants for the world and for this church. And Mormons have a heart for the sacred and a tough, sinewy muscle for the fight. So being in the fight is a sacred calling. Thank you.
Right.
Okay. Question.
If you have a question, I want to encourage you to just come up to the podium so that your voice can be heard on the recording.
Thank you, all of you, for your stories. And it helps us all not feel so alone in how we feel we need to resist in our sacred ways. I went to the Women's March as well and couldn't get to the Mormon women. And we were just across the street, but I honestly couldn't find them or get to them. But it was an amazing sacred experience for me, and empowering and wonderfully binding with all those women from all over the world with all their own reasons to be there. Such diversity, yet I felt such a connection. And my husband came with me, and my son, and my daughter, my sister, and my niece. And that was beautiful, too, to be with them. The sea of people, men, women. I loved how there was a chant that, you might help me with this, John. It was the men that started it. It was her body, her voice. And then the women, her body, her choice. And the women would repeat back, my body, my choice. And that was one of the main reasons why I was there, for women's voices and their choices and their own body and their own rights. And when I got home, I put it on Facebook and was happy and proud. And I wrote on Facebook how it reminded me of being on a mission, and how all the missionaries would stand up and sing "Call to Serve Him," you know, amazing, powerful song with just the unity of all these people from all around the world with such a unified cause. And it reminded me of, in Relief Society, how we sing as sisters in Zion, we all work together. And I think I read a post from you, Natasha, that you sang that at the retreat. It had such a deeper, intense spiritual meaning, singing that hymn, and it continues to do so after that march for me. I was called into the bishop's office, though, and asked what that placenta hat was about, and he didn't even know what that was. A great bishop of mine, he's my friend. Some people had complained, and I was in the Young Women's at the time, and they thought that I was marching for abortion rights, and I, in a sense, was. I mean, just a woman's right to choose. And I was told not to rock the boat, and I just did not appreciate that. And I said, Bishop, what did I do wrong? And he said, nothing. But I was released anyway. So that's been hard on me. But it's still a sacred resistance, and we need to keep fighting the fight. And there are risks, but it's worth it, because we need to be the voice of how things can be better in the church and in the world and in America. I was really grateful to hear General Authority, Elder Oaks, I think it was, say that we are allowed to have our political views. We are allowed to, we're allowed to debate and stand our ground, as long as we do it respectfully. And so I found a lot of solace in that, and I took that to my bishop, and he agreed. So let's keep fighting the fight. Thank you, everyone.
The only comment I'll say to that, you know, especially as a sex therapist, it's just so interesting to me how we allow societally and in many ways the crassness that we've seen around female anatomy, and yet, the outrage about the pussy hats. Not the outrage about the grabbing of the pussy, but that we would put pussy hats on our heads and reclaim our own anatomy was really shocking to me. And, similarly to you, as far as being released for doing nothing wrong, but because we make people uncomfortable, when Christ made everybody uncomfortable, I had a similar experience. I mean, I think I was released from my calling primarily for a lesson where I was talking about sexuality, and I mentioned the word clitoris, you know, in Relief Society. And yes, I know, it's funny. And I often do say it in a funny way, but I'm not saying it funny today because it's my clitoris. It's my vulva. It's my pussy. It's my vagina. I've had to listen to all kinds of things being said about them. Do not shame me for saying those words that I've been taught or not taught correctly. So thank you, Ruth, for sharing.
Gina, it's not, it didn't become clear to me during this why, as a citizen of New Zealand, you marched in Washington. Can you explain how that came to be?
Natasha forced me.
I'm used to it now. Well, you know what? There were three marches in New Zealand as well. Oh, yes. So this wasn't just a U.S. thing. This was an international event. I was just really privileged to be able to go and hold space and to attend that in Washington, D.C., but I would have been doing it in New Zealand as well.
Yeah, can you talk about maybe the feeling of things in New Zealand
and
how it looks to New Zealand?
Do you want to know, really? Yeah. Okay. There's a strain of, like, kind of American hubris that sort of, you know, has been long-standing irritation. And I suppose, you know, not dismissing all of the greatness and the goodness that goes over top of it, but we've been dragged into wars that we didn't start as allies of America, or dragged into kind of political battles that an economic system because we're allies or trade partners with America. And there's long-standing irritation about the role of the United States in World War II, et cetera, et cetera. So there's history. There's history. And I suppose what we saw with the election of Donald Trump was kind of the anthropomorphization of that particular character, And so I suppose on the one hand, it's like, oh, hell, you know, I hope he doesn't start a war because that commits us. I hope he doesn't collapse the economy because we're so entwined now. But America kind of got what it deserved. So, yeah, I hope that doesn't sound too offensive. Do you think I've got it right, Nath?
Yeah.
So we're watching. I mean, it's highly amusing. And we don't have to live with the consequences of it, you know. It's good SNL stuff and, you know, and Colbert and John Oliver. We're like, yeah, look at the latest outrages in America. Whoa, glad we don't live there. Glad our country's free. So, yeah. But thanks for asking.
Yeah, it is, you know, just carrying on from that, it is quite interesting, isn't it? Because when we don't like politicians, women in our country throw dildos at their faces, and some of you may have seen that. And I think actually John Oliver, he did a bit of a session on that. I'm kind of, you know, I'm interested to talk mainly, sorry, this, I don't mean to leave you out, Natasha, but because Gina and Jody are still going to church, it's kind of directed towards those who are still actively engaged and face this kind of issue with priesthood. Because, you know, our bishop has received a revelation to leave Gina alone. And he started picking on me instead. You know, she's got a great relationship with our state president, who used to be our home teacher, and also with the Area Authority 70, who's responsible for the island we live on. He grew up with Gina. And so the planets have kind of aligned in terms of the priesthood roulette, I guess. question I'd like to ask is, do you have any strategies in place for dealing with the potential for changes in priesthood leadership, and for you, Jody, how you deal with your priesthood leaders? Are there issues that you're confronting? Do you have any advice in terms of dealing with those in a way that enables you to remain engaged and positive without kind of suffering damage too much, I guess? Yeah.
I'm going to move to New Zealand.
No, this happened in the midst of, we had just barely moved to Salt Lake, and we had come from a place where, in a very short period of time, I'd gone from bishop's wife and Mike serving as bishop to Mike being released and me being released and not having a calling and pretty much everything about my faith being questioned, and not because of anything I had done. So that had gone on painfully, but again, pushing through it for almost exactly a year to when this march was. And we had moved here. I had actually been ready to think, well, if I feel the need, and I did, I felt that church is still a place not only for me, but important to me, and felt guided to stay involved. It was a, let's see how the ward is. And if it's not, we'll find other wards to go to. I'll find another place. And I know that that sounds so heretical when I think about my upbringing and everything. But I guess I'd gotten to the point where, you know, it's just like this. God is just saying, look, whatever you do is great. And I'd like you to keep stay a part of this community. And what God wasn't saying to me, but what I could hear myself saying, is because I know what a real awful person I become very quickly when I'm not kind of called into a structure. And our ward was incredible. And one of the things I did is I just flat out decided I was not going to friend anyone in my ward or stake on Facebook. Absolutely not. It did not matter what kind of privacy settings I used in our last ward. Somehow people just made a thing out of, even though I always kept my activism separate from church. Church is about Christ and inviting people to Christ. Activism is just what you're inspired to do in other forms, and it didn't matter. There were a few people in our ward and stake that just could not handle what they somehow knew I was doing, and so they kind of caused some real problems. I just decided there's not going to be any exposure on Facebook. Facebook is for the support and the activism. Church is for church. So that's separate. Now, it was only about 2 weeks after we had actually moved in, but a reporter came and interviewed Mike and I about a year out from the policy and our reactions and what the experience was for Mike as bishop and us, you know, me being involved in LGBT activism and everything. And it was on a major news network for Utah. The cat's kind of out of the bag, but we just weren't going to, you know, we didn't bring it up at church. But people at church, including leaders of the ward, came up and thanked us for doing that, thanked us, said that was an important thing. We have only received very positive and involved and great inquiries. It was like this constant surprise to us. So right now, I think it's good. I think the ward and the stake are seeing that Mike and I are there to serve, and we are serving, and we have great love for whatever it is we're doing, and we are hoping that if there is a change, they will see that too, and we just have to be ready for what comes.
I'm still going to answer it because I like to bother Nathan. No, because actually I'm getting ready to enter back into activity with my son, who's very interested in reengaging in Mormonism. And my reason for being inactive the last 3 years has nothing to do with me so much as it did with our daughter and situations that she was dealing with. So, and even prior to deciding to stop attending church, I was, I think, navigating those types of waters for probably about 5 years, ever since I really started my public writing on Mormonism and mental health and all those types of things. So I think for me personally, it really came to the point where I had to separate my own salvation and my own understanding of myself as a divine being and my own Mormonism, if you want to call it that, or whatever you want to call my spiritual religious beliefs, from the Mormon church and authority. Now, that came at great cost, because you kind of have to follow the rules to be able to play the game in our church. And I think that's what a lot of Gina is talking about with the patriarchy. So, for example, when I hit the button on my masturbation post, I knew at that point that I would not be returning for a temple recommend interview. I wasn't even going to try it. That's how I dealt with it. Like, I made that decision to withdraw myself from temple worship, which I have mixed feelings about anyway, but was not unwilling to go and worship in the temple. But I was unwilling to allow the males in my geographic community to have authority as to whether or not to decide if I could worship in that way. So that was a personal decision I made. There's lots of different ways to navigate those kinds of waters, but I did not have necessarily the friendly experience you're describing in your current ward, and we all know about ward roulette and bishop's roulette, and that, you know, all of us are in different, very different situations, given who we tend to worship at the time with. So I just want to honor the fact that I think it's beautiful and liberating and amazing to claim self-authority, and it's also profoundly tragic. And there's been great. Personal costs to not be able to live my Mormonism in my way because of how other people perceive my worthiness.
I warned you guys, right?
The question is if with our leaders changed. Blog about it. Make them afraid. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you know, Angry Gina says I'll get them. For me, being in the church is like just a spiritual practice. It's actually a spiritual practice to sit there and show compassion, even when things are really, really difficult to listen to take a deep breath and say, this means something to these people. That used to mean something to me. I've changed my life story, my moral order, and it's okay for us to be in communion with each other. And I think they know that about me. I think honesty is always the best policy, so I'm not always scrambling. So people kind of know how I feel about things, and I don't make that a weapon. I try not to make that a weapon. Well, I'm not very good. Sometimes we did have a big shouty thing a few months ago, didn't we? That was a little unpleasant with a very short lady. But yes, I don't know if they changed. I hope that I would love my leaders. I love my bishop. He was right to get a revelation to leave me alone. And so that tells me that God's in this as well. This is, he was absolutely convinced. He said to the Relief Society president, I've prayed and prayed and prayed about Gina, and I felt that I should just leave her alone. And that, to me, was a spiritual conviction. My state president said, I have wrestled what to do about you, and I keep feeling that I should just leave you alone, and we'll just check in with each other. That, to me, is God. As long as they're listening to God, then I'm good. And if they stop listening to God, I'll let them know before I do something. Yeah.
You know, along that line, it was interesting in our last ward here, and I do believe that Mike was released and I was released. It's connected. It's connected to a lot of things that were going on. They wouldn't be honest with us, but we heard enough to know that there was a lot of things connected. and I was released and not allowed really to teach officially. But I there was no disciplinary action. There was no, you've done this wrong, and so we're doing this. Because there, I hadn't done anything, and they couldn't explain it. All they could do was react to fear and see what they could do to... I think they really wanted me to leave. And guess what happens when someone tries to get me to do something I don't want to do? So it was like, yeah, I'll think about this a little bit. And but I'm an ordnance worker at the temple. And they didn't do anything about that. And that was salvation to me. My sisters that I served with there and the presidency that, you know, the matron there, she has a gay son too. We had spent a lot of time talking. And it just became more and more a sacred part of that practice for me. And it really helped me to minister to the people in my ward who were distraught because Mike was not the bishop and I wasn't teaching anymore. And so, yes, I do think God's doing stuff for people who will listen. And somehow things worked out. And I do think that to a certain extent, you know, that our bishop in this ward, right after this interview on TV and some other things that, you know, were probably to a certain extent public, he came and asked me to be an ordnance worker here. And, you know, you just don't know. It's not like that's the correct thing. It's just, it's making a difference in how I experience and practice things, and I think that's important. And I'm grateful for it now. And someday the question will be asked, when I was hungry, did you feed me? And if something ever comes down to you, if you're going to go and feed this person and shelter them, you won't be able or allowed to do this in our community. I've made my choice.
You know, when you said that you weren't wanted, that's really hard to be rejected, right? Especially from your faith community. And I remember when we went inactive, I was like, oh no, now all the visiting teachers are going to come and the priests, the home teachers, and eventually probably the bishopric is going to come visit and all the brownies we're going to have to eat. And I was, you know, kind of, okay, well, I'm ready. And nothing came. Nobody came. Right? So that was shocking. After, I mean, I'm talking about a lifetime of dedicating my time and my money and my energy and my free professional services. I mean, lifetime of giving to this, you know, family of mine. So I go back and forth. I mean, there's a part of me that's blessed and happy to be ignored because that means I'm not being disciplined formally, and I've seen that route as well. And then there's a part of me that's profoundly wounded by the being ignored and being set aside very easily. So as I go back to your question, I plan to show up and smile. And probably I don't have the credibility or the relationship I had before to raise my hand at Sunday school. So I'll probably walk out a lot. That will be my way to say I don't agree. And I'm being very strategic about what I will or will not be willing to do. But I'll show up.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for your questions and comments. It's 6:30. Let's give a final round of applause to our panel.